This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the problem of debt in America. And here's just an amazing statistic to start with. Over the past generation, incomes in America have risen an average of 1% in real terms. Over that same period, household debt has increased over 1,000%. And all you have to do these days is open up a news magazine or a newspaper to see that it has become very clear that growing numbers of Americans are in over their heads. Foreclosures are hitting record highs. Americans are declaring bankruptcy at rates 10 times that during the Great Depression. This morning, we'll try to talk a little bit about how we got to this point and perhaps also what might be done about it. And our guest for the program is writer-filmmaker James Scurlock, and he is the author of a newly published book titled Maxed Out, Hard Times, Easy Credit, and the Era of Predatory Lenders. The book is published by Scribner. He's also been involved with a film of the same title, a feature-length film. Maxed Out is the title of the movie. It won the special jury prize at the South by Southwest Film Festival 2006 and also has been accepted for inclusion in a number of other festivals. It has been and will, I'm sure, continue to be shown around the country. It is also available on a DVD if you would like to see it. Perhaps we can talk a little bit about that as we talk with our guest, James Scurlock. And also about what you can find in the book. And certainly you want to read the book, you can head down to the bookstore and take a look at it. James Scurlock studied at the Wharton School of Business at University of Pennsylvania. His first film, Parents of the Year, won a number of awards and was an official selection of more than 25 film festivals. And as I mentioned, Maxed Out won at South by Southwest. Questions are welcome here on the program, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. At any point here, people have questions, you can call. We just ask people to be brief so that we can keep moving along. But anyone is certainly interested. Anyone who's interested in being in on the conversation can certainly pick up the telephone and give us a call. Mr. Scurlock, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Good.
I just can't quite wrap my head around that statistic that's in the book. That is about how household incomes have risen over the last generation about 1%, but over that same time, debt has increased over 1,000%. And I suppose that does include things like, people have mortgages. Maybe that's not, some kind of mortgages, I guess, maybe not a big issue. Is most of that the result of an increase in unsecured debt, like credit card debt?
Yeah, exactly. That's unsecured debt, and mainly that is credit card debt. Unfortunately, as we're finding out with this whole mortgage mess, people have used their home equity and their second mortgages to pay off that credit card debt and then started the clock running all over again. Mm-hmm. So the amount of debt out there is much larger than most people realize.
And how do we compare to other countries on this?
Well, we're pretty much the worst. I mean, the United Kingdom and South Korea aren't too far behind us. Europe and Japan tend to be much better than we are, although this phenomenon of escalating home prices, at least in larger cities, has hit just about everyone. And the Dutch are now the most indebted people in the world, but it's almost all mortgage debt.
Let's just talk about basically what's going on here. And I know that the basic kind of thrust that you take in Maxed Out, both the book and the movie, and that is that the problem here, you really want to lay this at the floor, at the feet, at the door, one of those two things,
right?
of the industry, of the lending industry. And I suppose there are two different ways that you can look at this. Either that the problem is that the industry in an irresponsible way has made credit so widely available that people have gotten themselves in trouble. The other side of that is to say, it's up to consumers to be responsible in their use of credit. And if you go out there and if a credit card company will give you a credit limit of $10,000, that doesn't mean you have to go out the next day and spend $10,000. I mean, where do you think the greater responsibility lies here? Is it with the industry or is it with people who have just been really careless in how they've spent their money?
Right. Let me put it this way. The embarrassing truth is that I started out wanting to do a comedy. I thought I was going to make the Super Size Me of credit and show a lot of people who are just making very bad choices or who are very irresponsible, because that's the conventional wisdom, that this is all about American lifestyles and Americans being $30,000 millionaires or living beyond their means. That's where I started, and that's where the film starts, and that's where the book starts. You know, in Las Vegas 3 years ago, when it was the hottest real estate market in the country, and there were all these flippers and speculators making hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, on empty plots of land in the desert. However, when I started getting into this subject, what really fascinated me was, what's changed? You know, not necessarily who's more responsible, because I think that's almost an impossible question, but, you know, why is it so much worse now than it was a generation ago? And when you ask that question, the only answer is the lending industry has absolutely revolutionized the way it's done business, and the way it's sold debt, and its success at getting people to borrow more and more and more at higher rates with higher fees. So that's what's changed.
Well, do you think that somehow, as a society, and if the answer is yes, and I think the answer is going to be yes, and we can talk about how that happened, but that somehow, as a society, we came to the point where we came to believe that being highly leveraged was somehow no big deal, that it really wasn't a problem, and it shouldn't keep us awake at night.
You know, that is a mentality that has been sold and is sold every minute of every day by the banks and credit card companies and mortgage companies. You know, the solicitations, the direct mail offers, the convenience checks, the internet banner ads, the telephone calls, you know, on and on and on and on. That's definitely something that that has been drilled into us by these companies. And that they're spending billions and billions of dollars trying to make us believe, and it's not true. If you go back to the founding of this country, though, this country was founded by speculators. George Washington was a speculator. Thomas Jefferson was in debt all of his life. You know, the reason we have the Federal Reserve, the reason that we have or had a lot of these regulations, was because of financial panics, and because Americans are so good at getting in over their heads. And we're so optimistic. So we, you know, we really are a nation of risk takers and a nation of debtors. And I don't think that has changed since the beginning of this country.
Well, so what is the fact that we have more people that owe more money than they can hope to
pay
back?
I think that the difference is, you know, it's sort of a conspiracy of fools, to borrow a phrase from Kurt Eichenwald. I mean, you have people who are very optimistic on the one hand, and irrationally exuberant, perhaps, consumers. And on the other hand, you have lenders who are supposed to be prudent and responsible. And when they both move in the same direction, and when they both decide that they're just going to borrow everything that they can, the situation gets out of hand. You know, that being said, the statistic you started the show with, income's up only 1% and expenses up much, much higher than that. I mean, you didn't mention expenses, but the cost of college, housing, health care, and a number of other very important things have gone up dramatically over the last generation. So there's a lot of people who are just trying to fill the gap, and, you know, lo and behold, they can get a credit card, they can get a home equity loan, they can get all sorts of debt that they couldn't get a generation ago to fill that gap.
Yeah. And I suppose, in fairness, one has to say that for good or ill, we have this tendency to estimate our, measure our well-being by our level of material prosperity, and that's just the necessary markers seem to be, you know, the price on the necessary markers seems to be going up all the time.
Well, the great thing about debt is you don't even have to be prosperous. You know, the credit card companies have been extremely talented, and some might say nefarious, at exploiting what you're talking about with platinum cards and preferred cards and gold cards and black cards and select cards, and, you know, and delineating every one of us into some stratus, you know, some tier of success, and always having one more tier that we need to graduate up to. We do define ourselves in terms of our financial success in this country, and that's why being broke is such a scary thought.
Yeah, I think just it makes me think about how just recently I heard about the fact that apparently that there are some lenders who are now pioneering a new kind of auto loan that instead of being what I guess would be the norm would be a 4-year loan, now they're offering 7-year loans.
Yep.
And that's a way of saying, you know, you thought you couldn't afford a Mercedes-Benz. Well, let me tell you something. We can make that possible for you, and you know, we just tack another 3 years onto what is the average time for a loan. And
right.
It just seems that there's more and more people are trying to figure out some way that they can tempt you into spending money, probably more money than you should.
Sure. I mean, I was talking to a mortgage broker in Las Vegas, and he said the only question his clients ask is, how can you get me in the biggest house, you know, for this payment? You know, so they're really, by design, maxing people out. They're saying, if you can, you know, what can you afford? If you go to an auto dealership today, or even a mortgage broker, the first question you may hear is, what can you afford? You know, and then the payment's always going to be more than that. So exactly, it's get you into Mercedes, get you into a bigger house, get you into something more.
Well, and I also certainly recall the experience of going in to qualify for the loan for the house that I'm in now 10 years ago or something like that, and the qualification process you go through and you give them all their financial information, and then they tell you what you can afford. And I've talked with a lot of people who had the same experience that they felt that the bank told them that they could afford more than they personally felt that they could afford.
Sure.
And they were willing to lend much more money than I was comfortable in borrowing.
Sure. I mean, it was reported that if you went on to Citibank's mortgage calculator online recently, they would, you know, quote you up to 50% or a little more of your income as being affordable. You know, clearly that's not affordable.
Why one wonders when you take a look at the situation that we have now, where we have maybe a lot of people who have run up very big debts on their credit cards, or perhaps we have people who signed up for home mortgages, particularly the adjustable rate mortgage, where perhaps in the beginning the rate was very attractive, but then the rate increased very quickly. They didn't expect that, and suddenly they can't meet their mortgage payments, and they are in default. You would have to think that one way or another that the lenders, whether they're the people who are extending the credit on the credit cards or the people that are doing the mortgages, would look at people whose credit was questionable and would say to themselves, well, we're taking a risk here. I mean, what happens if we lend this person money and they can't pay it back? You would think that it would be in the interest of the lender to be conservative, because after all, if they lend money and the person can't pay it back, then they're stuck.
You know, this is one of the things that I learned when I was making Maxed Out and when I was writing the book. That's absolutely not correct. This business has gotten so counterintuitive and so bizarre and so absurd that all of the assumptions that you make turn out to be incorrect. When a mortgage is originated now, it is almost always sold immediately upstream to investors in Wall Street. It's pooled with a bunch of other mortgages. Credit card debt is sold the same way. Auto loans are sold the same way. Pretty much every kind of consumer debt you can think about. So the originator, the person who is making that loan or originating the mortgage, isn't worried about what happens next year or next week. They're just worried about getting that mortgage closed so they can sell it and make a profit. And after that, it's someone else's problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what's going to make this mortgage mess so difficult to figure out, because it's not like the local bank is holding on to someone's mortgage and they can go back now and renegotiate it. That mortgage was sold at least once and probably many times, and the person who is holding it now has no idea, you know, what was promised or what was discussed back when the customer actually walked in the door and was sold this mortgage.
It just, it's interesting. I just was reported yesterday that the bank that happens to be my bank and holds that my mortgage just announced that they were having to do some significant layoffs as a result of the shakeout of what's happened with the mortgage crisis. And apparently, the part of their problem is that they're stuck holding some bad paper that they now can't get rid of.
Right. There are 15 mortgage companies so far have declared bankruptcy and gone out of business. Since this whole thing started, you know, that's like Enron. I've heard that the layoffs from this mortgage crisis are going to be greater than the layoffs after 9/11 in the airline industry. So, you know, it's happened so quickly, and it's such a big industry that those layoffs alone are pretty devastating. I mean, you saw this morning 4,000 jobs were lost, the first net job loss in 4 or 5 years. Quite shocking.
Well, we have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. We'll do that in just a moment here. I also would like to introduce again our guest. He's a filmmaker and writer. His name's James Scurlock, and he is involved with a film and a book. They both have the same title. It's Maxed Out. It takes a look at credit problem here in the country. The film is available on DVD. It's possible that where you live, you might actually be able to see it on a big screen. It has played around the United States. And of course, the book, you can just go down to the bookstore and look for that. It's published by Scribner. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. We have several callers here. We'll get right to them, starting with line number one. And this is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Oh, yeah. Hi. This is a very important issue because of the fact that if you read the literature, like The Economist and other things and other publications from the SEC and all these kinds of people like that, you'll notice that, and you're right about them selling these mortgages upstream and all this debt upstream to hedge funds and overseas investors who have been, you know, buy these things as like bonds or instruments, which now turn out to be virtually worthless. I think the Salomon Brothers just blew off three of their hedge funds, lost about $6 billion. And this reminds me of the long-term capital management thing I've mentioned on this program before in 98, where you had these, you know, two Nobel Prize laureates and et cetera, develop this algorithm to sort of look at modeled trading commodities and, you know, counter commodities and hedge funds. It was a hedge fund, and it was losing at the time. It failed $100 million a day. And I'm quite sure that the losses in this field are going to be maybe hundreds of billions of dollars. But I'm worried about, do you discuss regulation in your book or lack of regulation? Because when these things leave offshore, they become non-transparent. Nobody knows. As a matter of fact, if you listen to you know, the European press talk about the failure of the German banks, there's a few German banks that are really stuck with a lot of this stuff. They're talking about the fact that there was no regulation. Nobody knew what the value of these instruments are. And I know this gets complex, but I'm wondering if you talk about that. Could you mention that, please?
Yeah, I do talk about it. And it's interesting because Alan Greenspan was giving a speech yesterday and compared this to long-term capital management and also compared it to 1987, the stock market crash, and the financial panic of 1907. Mm-hmm. But one of the consumer lawyers I talked to when I was doing the book called this process of selling mortgages upstream mortgage laundering, because in the process everything just sort of gets lost, and the fraudulent mortgages and the bad loans get pooled with the good ones, and, you know, and before too long nobody can really figure out, you know, what's good, what's bad, what really happened. Now the SEC and other regulators are desperately trying to figure out where all of these, you know, all of these bad loans are, and trying to figure out what exposure the different banks have. But I don't think anyone really knows. I think that it's, you know, the regulation has been so lax for so long that no one's going to be able to figure out where these things are until they start to blow up. And they are. They're in Germany. They're in France. They're in Asia. The European stock markets actually went down more than the U.S. stock markets did over this job loss news. So, you know, it's pervasive, yeah. And it's very scary.
Yeah, it's real scary. And the whole thing is that I'm worried. I mean, and not that it affects me so much, but it is about the overall, the world economy, where in 98 you had the Federal Reserve basically bail out and, you know, had these instruments bought by some Citibank and a few banks in Europe when it was failing. I mean, that there's a paper that we used to be published on the SEC site that was done, commissioned by them. It's very, very explores this whole issue. And what's really interesting is how upset the SEC and the Fed were, and how the European bank community was so upset, because this thing is basically beginning to bring down, you know, the world financial system. And I'm wondering if this thing is beneath the veneer of all the happy talk and all this BS, mm-hmm. is a really, really negative effect on the world economy. But thank you. I really appreciate your work. Thank you. Bye.
No, thank you. And I'll say something. The biggest worry I have, I think the biggest threat in all of this, is that the confidence in the United States economy will be lost. We've always prided ourselves on our transparency, you know, and the stability of the U.S. dollar. That's just received another huge blow.
Let's talk next with someone else. This is someone in Champaign, and it's line number two. Hello.
Yes, I kind of want to relay a personal situation, and that is, I have a son who's ready to buy another home. I guess it's a trade-up from his condo, he and his wife. And I was very worried when I received notice of this, because they're not able right now, not even put their condo on the market. So my risk-averse question was, should you get into a situation where you have two mortgages? And then I breathed a sigh of relief yesterday, saying, well, no way the mortgage lender would loan him money for a new house unless they felt comfortable that he could handle two mortgages, at least for a finite period of time. But what I've heard from you is conceivable that they could loan their mortgage for this new house, even though, quite frankly, they may not be able to afford it in light of the lax granting of credit. Am I right in there?
Oh, that's absolutely correct. You know, in the past several months, to give you an idea of how absurd this whole thing is, the Federal Reserve and Congress had to come out with new guidance telling banks, make sure that your customers can afford a mortgage before you sell it to them. You know, this is the most basic kind of due diligence that a bank is supposed to do, and they weren't doing it. They had to be reminded to do it. Countrywide, the largest mortgage lender in the country just came out and said, well, we're now going to make sure that people can afford the mortgage when it resets, you know, these adjustable rate mortgages. So you're absolutely right. I mean, no one has been, tending to this, and no one has been making certain that the mortgage was affordable. And people mistakenly thought, well, if, you know, Citibank or if Countrywide is willing to make this loan, that means that I can afford it, and that's absolutely not true anymore.
Oh, wow. And that's because everybody now is selling the mortgages and not holding on to them as apparently they did a long time ago.
Right. There's a woman in the film. She's a Harvard Law School professor who's written a number of books and really done the hard research in this area. And the only word she could come up with for how profitable this industry has been was obscene. It's obscenely profitable, she kept saying. And, you know, when something is obscenely profitable, nobody asks very many questions.
All right. Well, thank you, sir.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to another Champaign caller. This is line three. Hello.
Hi. In terms of, I understand, I don't know how true this is, but I think it's something I read. The bank, bank cards, I actually view them as sort of juice loans, but anyway, 18% and all that. That they're selling back a certain part of their bad debt to investment groups that in turn for 10 cents on a dollar for collection or something or other, is that, you know, this is a whole new industry now that these groups are, you know, pressuring people and all that kind of stuff. I guess, have you heard of this, or is this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, we went out to Minneapolis and met these two guys who had started a debt-buying firm. And it's a hugely profitable industry because there's so much bad debt out there right now that you can go really with almost no experience, you know, no license, no anything, and go out there and buy some bad credit card debt or bad auto loans or bad mortgages or whatever for pennies on the dollar. And just start calling people up and, you know, and harassing them or whatever, and you know, if you can get a few of those loans to pay, then you've made a fortune.
The other one is that the change in law in terms of bankruptcy that the banks got through, has any bank actually foreclosed on any people's, or, you know, people's these debtors, you know, in terms of their house and things of that nature? What's ever happened there?
Sure. I mean, you know, it just came out yesterday that foreclosures have hit an all-time high. So the banks are definitely out there foreclosing.
But this is on, but you know, a bank card you could file for, you could take, go into bankruptcy, but I think they, remember that a while back where they got the that legislation in that the banks could, in fact, go after the money.
You mean bankruptcy reform?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, bankruptcy reform was passed back in 1995, and the situation was the bankruptcy rates had skyrocketed, you know, getting more than 10 times that during the Great Depression. I mean, just huge. And so Congress's solution was, let's make it that much harder and more expensive for people to get out from under. It really didn't make any sense. They limited debate to half an hour on each side. They wouldn't allow amendments. And this was a time when a lot of National Guardsmen and women were already suffering and losing their businesses and losing their jobs. They didn't make any allowance for them. Then Katrina hit. No allowance was made for those people. You know, and now millions of people are at risk losing their homes in the subprime mortgage mess, and no allowance is being made for them. So it's just a very, very difficult and heartbreaking time if you're having a hard time making ends meet, and there's not a whole lot of compassion offered to you, because if you default, that bank or that credit card company can just attach a bunch of fees and interest to whatever it was you didn't pay, package it as bad debt, and sell it off as an asset, you know, and get a tax write-off. So, you know, that's the industry we have now.
And then finally, you know, our federal government's not a very good example of how you should manage money, too. So, anyway, final comment.
Right, well, that's absolutely right.
Just for a second to hang with talking about the bankruptcy reform, I think it's really worth making the point that here at the time, I think the industry persuaded Congress that this was necessary because they said that, well, you know, there are all these people out there that are in trouble, but it's because of irresponsible use of credit, that's really the problem, and that people like that shouldn't be able to take advantage of the bankruptcy law. And when, in fact, if you take a look at the people who were filing for bankruptcy, that wasn't the reason. That wasn't why most people, because they went out and got 10 credit cards and they charged them up to their limits. It was, for example, people who had been really sick, or had a family member who was really sick, and they had big medical bills.
Right.
So it really was, it not only was it intended to target a problem that didn't really exist, but it wasn't going to do anything for anybody except make it more difficult for people who already were on the bottom rungs of the ladder, so to speak, to use whatever kinds of protections and help bankruptcy law could afford.
Right. And it's a great example of why Congress's approval rating is at a historic low. You know, just it was a very bad decision that didn't reflect the reality and didn't reflect the tradition of this country.
Let's continue. Let's talk with somebody else. The next is also someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
What about this idea? Suppose I want to take a loan. I go to a loan company, and I say, "Okay, you give me a loan. If you sell it, I get part of the proceeds." And it keeps on doing that. Would that, you know, is that possible? I'll take my answer off the air.
You know, you can give it a try. I kind of doubt that it's possible, but you're certainly welcome to try.
So you wouldn't think that, you know, for example, that there would be any interest in Congress, for example, of instituting something like that, if even Congress would be in a position to institute.
You know, I don't think so. It's funny. We went to Macon, Mississippi, and we were talking to this one woman who had lost her home in foreclosure, and she said, you know, they just sold my mortgage so many times, I didn't know who to pay. You know, I mean, these things just get bought and sold and bought and sold and bought and sold so many times, and unfortunately, the consumer is never making money, and the consumer only seems to end up getting charged more and being more confused.
Is there much interest either on the part of state legislatures or perhaps in Congress in getting involved in setting some kind of caps on what kind of interest rates can be charged on any kind of loan? And I know particularly this is it's of concern a lot of places for short-term loans, things like payday lenders. And, of course, there are some places where they operate with no restrictions at all. There are some states where they're, you can charge as much as you feel like charging.
Right.
Is there much interest in trying to restrict at all interest rates?
No. You know, until 1978, we not only had interest, we had usury laws in virtually every state in this country that limited the interest rate that could be charged. And in 1978, the Supreme Court decided, by interpreting a congressional law pretty narrowly, that you could export interest rates, meaning that if one state had no usury law, had no interest rate cap, that if the bank was based there, then they could charge customers in any state of the union whatever interest rate they wanted to, which is exactly what happened. South Dakota got rid of its usury law. Delaware got rid of its usury law. And that's why all the credit card companies are based in those two states, because they just export whatever interest rate they choose to charge. Now, President Bush recently, responding to the troubles that so many members of the military have gotten into, set a 36% interest rate cap on what can be charged to military families. And part of the reason for that was because so many soldiers couldn't be deployed because they were considered a security risk because their credit was so bad. So, no, unfortunately, there's really been no interest nationally for any sort of usury law except for the military.
Yeah.
And every time lawmakers try and institute some sort of interest rate cap on payday lenders or title loan holders, these really, really super loan sharking kind of operations, they just say, well, it's not really interest rate, it's a fee or it's a service charge.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. I have other callers we'll get to in just a moment. I'd like to introduce again the guest. He's a writer, filmmaker, James Scurlock. He studied at the Wharton School of Business at University of Pennsylvania. His first film, Parents of the Year, won a number of awards and was an official selection of more than 25 film festivals. His first feature-length film, Maxed Out, won the special jury prize at South by Southwest. It has played in a number of cities around the country. It is now available on a DVD, if you would like to look at it. And also, he has a book that deals with the same subject and has the same title. The title of the book is Maxed Out, Hard Times, Easy Credit, and the Era of Predatory Lenders, and it's published by Scribner. We have a couple of people here ready to go, both of them in Urbana. The next in line is line two, right here. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
36-38% interest. That's real reform, isn't it? I have a question, though. How heavy... how much does the loan industry contribute to congressional and other elections?
That's a great question, and I should add that the banks have been lobbying to be exempted from that 36% law since the day it was passed. The banks and financial industry are tremendous contributors. In fact, I'll give you one example. Hillary Clinton convinced her husband in 2000 to veto the bankruptcy reform law when it came to his desk, and he had previously supported it. The last official act of President Bill Clinton was actually vetoing the Bankruptcy Reform Act that then passed in 2005. After she became a New York senator, which is obviously representing a pretty big chunk of the financial industry, She changed courses. Now, she was the only senator who didn't vote on the bankruptcy bill one way or the other, but she had changed sides by then. So the financial industry is very, very influential, not only because they contribute so much money, but because I think most members of Congress see them as controlling the strings of the economy. And, you know, my God, what would happen if they suddenly took away all this easy credit and the economy came to a screeching halt? Now, if you look at the numbers in the past several weeks and look at what's happening on Wall Street today and, you know, and what's happening in the jobs market, that's probably going to happen anyway. You know, members of Congress and politicians have just been terrified that the financial industry would take the punch bowl away and the economy would collapse.
Also interested in that statistic you started out with, a 1% gain in average income over the last, 20 years?
Right.
And given even the moderate inflation of, I think it's averaged around 3% during that period, that means that we've gotten collectively a lot poorer.
Well, we have. You know, the productivity boom was theoretically supposed to make us all richer, but what it's apparently done is just make corporations much wealthier and made the vast majority of us unable to keep up with the cost of things like healthcare and housing and education.
What happens when the American consumer no longer can consume? Does the entire world economy collapse?
You know, it's funny. That's a great question, and that's the one question that no one seems to be asking right now. Everyone is so consumed by and concerned by what if the lenders stop lending, which is what's happening. You know, it's Wall Street said we're not going to buy any more of these subprime mortgage loans or, you know, asset-backed securities because they're much riskier than advertised. So the Fed came in and said, and the European central banks came in and said, look, we'll make available all the money you want. You know, there's plenty of liquidity. The Treasury Secretary just came out this morning and said, we're working behind the scenes to make sure that there's plenty of money. But there's another side to that equation, which is what if people just stop borrowing? And what if people are just maxed out? What if people just, can't go back and refinance anymore, can't go take on any more debt? And what happens then? You know, I think we're about to find out.
Well, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Program.
Next, we'll talk with someone on line three. This is also someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for a very, very educational program, really. I want to go back to a question about the mortgages. Where does the, I think it's called Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac,
mm-hmm.
where do those corporations fit into the sale and resale of, or the issuing and repurchase of mortgages?
Well, what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac do is they guarantee these mortgages up to a certain amount. I think it's $417,000, and that's what's called a conforming mortgage. So they facilitate the making of a whole lot of mortgages. That's their role. It's billions and billions of dollars. I think Fannie Mae is at $4 or $5 billion. Freddie Mac is quite a bit smaller than that, but they're trying to expand their own business, and they're trying to get authorization to take on bigger loans. In my state of California, the average home is now over $500,000. So you literally can't get a mortgage that is guaranteed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac to cover the entire house. But that's what those agencies do.
So then they're original issuers of to individuals if they specifically
no. What they do one of two things. They either guarantee the mortgage and they charge a fee for that.
To the initial bank.
Exactly. To whoever originates the mortgage, whether it's a countrywide or whether it's a bank or whoever it is, and they charge a fee. Or in some cases, they actually buy the mortgages themselves.
So then they would be the first repurchaser. First purchaser.
Basically, they're the guarantor.
What I don't understand is the guarantor part of it, because if I understood what you said before, the mortgages are issued to an individual. Then they are bundled almost randomly, it sounds like, and sold to other financial groups. I don't even know if they're institutions or groups or hedge funds or what. Do Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac buy the bundled mortgages?
And generally, no. They just insure the mortgages themselves. So, you know, in that bundle, you might have all mortgages that were backed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, or you might not. Mortgages, for example, cannot be guaranteed by those companies, or you might have uninsured mortgages. The mortgages that they guarantee are called conforming mortgages. Non-conforming mortgages are ones that are not.
Okay, so if people start to not pay their mortgage payments, and companies are foreclosing, then if some of the conforming mortgages are owned by Fannie Mae, they won't foreclose?
Well,
because Fannie Mae will give them the money?
No, not necessarily. Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac would either repurchase them or take them back or whatnot. It wouldn't affect, if someone isn't paying their mortgage, it doesn't mean that they themselves are protected. It means that, the bank or the originator of the mortgage or the owner of the mortgage is protected from loss.
I see. And I guess at some point the owners of the mortgage in these big repurchase packages, they start unbundling the packages as individual mortgages, sort of.
Well, maybe not. It just depends. They're generally sold in these big trusts and they have a yield. They look very much like a bond, and theoretically, there's no reason to unbundle them. Some will default. Some will not perform. But theoretically, the overwhelming number of them will perform and will keep that return, whatever return was guaranteed, intact, and there would be no reason to unbundle it.
Interesting. Thank you.
It's very complicated.
I've got more questions, but it's a little too complicated for me to even formulate them at this point. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, just I guess, again, if you think about the fact that what has happened now is that you have a bank or lending institution lends a person the money to buy a house, there would have been, and the house itself, the property secures the loan, so there would have been a time when the bank would hold that mortgage, and then if the person couldn't make their payments, well, then the bank got the house and presumably got to recover its money. What
right.
happens now is that banks, they don't want to mess around with that. They don't want to wait to get that money back. They don't
right.
want to be encumbered but with pieces of property as security. They say, okay, we made the loan, now let's get rid of this. And they want to then sell that mortgage to somebody else who's quite willing to come along and buy it. So then the bank just, manages to make whatever cash up front they can out of the whole deal, and then they're shed of the responsibility. I guess that one of the things that that might happen is there some way to make it to the bank's advantage to actually hold the mortgage rather than selling it on, then it would be in their interest to perhaps be more careful about who it is they were lending money to.
Right, and I think I think that would be a terrific idea. It used to be that you couldn't own a bank in more than one state. In some places like Texas, you could only have one bank branch. In places like New York, you could only operate in one city, and that meant that local banks really cared and were very much invested in their local community. And if the community was having a hard time, or if they were seeing a lot of foreclosures or a lot of people in default, the bank could hold on to that property or work with people you know, and really try and manage the situation locally, that's not possible anymore. You know, you can have a situation where suddenly, you know, these mortgages are owned by the Chinese central bank and European central bank and, you know, whoever else, and everyone panics at once, and suddenly, you know, all of these things go on the market at the same time because no one's looking out for the individual communities.
Well, now we're coming down to the point here. We have maybe 3 or 4 minutes left. I guess that then the big question here again to return to is, we've known for some time that there were a lot of people that were overextended, and that a lot of that had to do with unsecured credit, like credit cards.
Right.
And that now with the mortgage crisis, it's just one more big thing layered on top of that. And so you think now we're at a point now where this should get Congress's attention. It should get the attention of regulators, perhaps both on the state and federal level, and they should look at the situation now, and that they should do something. You know, the question is, well, what? I mean, is there going to, do you think that there is likely to be some kind of significant response by government, short of, you know, the government saying to the banks, now, please, just be a little bit more careful about who you lend your money to?
Well, I think it does have Congress's attention. You know, it even has the president's attention now. I think 6 months ago, nobody knew what subprime was, or very few people knew. I think now everybody knows what subprime means and is very aware of this problem. I think one thing that Congress could do immediately is to repeal the Bankruptcy Reform Act. I think there's millions of people, millions of households out there who are not going to be able to hang on to their homes. It's just too burdensome. And when these interest rate resets go off, when these time bombs go off, they're just not going to have any chance at all. And the best thing for them is going to be to get a fresh start. Clearly, there needs to be more, you know, regulation of these products. And clearly, you know, the industry is already beginning to sort of re-regulate itself and tighten its standards, but all of the discussion that I've seen recently is about saving individual homeowners, and you know that's very difficult to do. And from President Bush's proposal, which I think would affect 80,000 people, to Hillary Clinton's proposal, which is $1 billion mega fund out of an $8 trillion mortgage market, you know, it just seems like much too little, much too late.
On the other side of this equation, there is the attitude of individuals about money and about debt. And, you know, we have talked about, and people certainly are aware that the savings rate, for example, in the United States is quite low, and that maybe has something to do with the fact that now, for some time, there has been pretty easy access to credit. Now, that may change, but it's been pretty easy to borrow money. We're told that spending money is a good thing. We're even told it's patriotic to spend money. So then there seems to be room here for some significant change in all of our attitudes towards saving and spending.
No, absolutely. You know, I was on Nightline the other night, and a lobbyist for the banking industry came on and said, well, you know, the great thing about a credit card is if you have an emergency, it's there. Yeah, that's been true for a while, but there's a big difference between having money in the bank and having a credit card. And what, ironically enough, the mortgage companies and the banks have learned over the past, you know, several months is that credit line can be taken away at any moment. That credit is not an asset. You know, that is something with terms and conditions that can change overnight or can simply disappear overnight. So this idea that we have that our credit card is an emergency fund, or that credit is the same as cash, or this easy instant credit is always going to be around, is just absolutely false.
And yet it's in you know, sadly enough, it's something though that we've really learned to live with, to depend on. There are some cases where, you know, depending on what you're doing, you absolutely have to have one. So we've also come to a point where it's difficult to exist without one.
Absolutely, and I think that's very much by design. And I always hear people say, "Oh, you know, you have to have a credit card. How do you do this and that?" Mm-hmm. You know, the Japanese don't use credit cards, or hardly use credit cards at all. Germans, those are very advanced, industrialized nations, and they seem to do just fine without them. So, you know, this dependency that we've we've developed on our credit cards is not something that was preordained, I think, or something that was inevitable.
Mm-hmm. Well, here, can't help wondering where we're headed here, and now whether things are in fact even going to get worse. Is there some other kind of problem that you think is lurking, or have we seen the worst?
Well, we certainly haven't seen the worst. I'm not sure I'd use the word depression, but you look at all the numbers, and they are very scary. What's most frightening about this whole thing is how it's all interlaced. You know, the Fed was saying months ago, "Oh, this is just subprime mortgages, and it's contained. It's not a big deal." But the truth is, there aren't these Chinese walls around things like subprime mortgages. You know, people use their homes to pay off their credit card bills, and they use their credit card bills to pay off other credit cards, and so on and so on and so on. So this is something that goes very broad, that's very interrelated. And I think the worst is yet to come. I think we've got something like $800 billion of mortgages that are resetting in the next year, which is going to be a huge problem. And we also have a problem that people just, aren't able to keep up with all the debt they've taken on.
Well, on that cheerful note, we will finish for this part of Focus 580. If you're interested in reading more on the subject, I certainly would recommend that you look at the book that we mentioned. The title is Maxed Out, and it's published by Scribner, by our guest James Scurlock. Also, there is a film, a documentary, a full-length film that he has made of the same title, and it is available on DVD if you would like to see it. Mr. Scurlock, thanks very much.
Thank you. I wish I could be more optimistic.